Welcome to the FinTech Newscast. This is Monica, and today we're going to be covering the introduction of T-Mobile's T-Money, what's going on with the latest round of upcoming IPOs here in Silicon Valley, and credit card marketing coming to your Instagram feed. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. So, today you've got a skeleton crew. It's Steve and it's Monica, because John's gallivanting all around, not helping us, not supporting us.
Nothing. He's on special assignment somewhere in Southeast Asia, scoping out fintech newscast opportunities. He's actually working on a really interesting report. Not really.
We're just kidding. He's on a much-deserved vacation.
Yes.
So, today we're going to start off with some announcements from T-Mobile, which you might be thinking, why are we talking about T-Mobile?
Well, funny enough, T-Mobile is now a fintech player. Who knew, right? Yeah, so in mid-April, T-Mobile announced T-Mobile Money, which is their new offering. It comes with a debit card, and it's essentially a digital bank account that you can use tied to your T-Mobile account. You can earn interest on that. You can do no-fee deposits at ATMs across the country, and as well as withdrawals. And it also has a pretty interesting 4% annual percentage yield, which is higher than you see across the industry, although there are caveats to that.
So let's talk about those caveats, because a 4% interest rate, that would get me excited.
Outstanding. I think I get maybe 2.4% from Amex right now, so, you know. But the issue is that this only covers balances up to $3,000.
Okay, so if you're keeping a lot of money in a checking account, which maybe that's not the best place to get the best APR anyway, T-Money isn't the place to do it. But this is very interesting. So how many Americans do you think have balances under $3,000 on an average basis?
I would say most Americans, right? Isn't it the famous stat that most people can come up with $400 on short notice, right?
Yeah, yeah. So for hundreds of millions of Americans, 4% on all of their savings would be like, hey!
Pretty sweet.
That's better than the 0.0005 I'm getting in a money market account
right,
or whatever
right,
it might
right,
be.
Right, yeah. It just works, yeah. This is, of course, the first telco to do this, but I wonder what's in it for them?
Yeah, so some of the things that come to my mind is that they're really trying to capture relatively younger customers. Mm-hmm. So, and full disclosure, I'm a T-Mobile customer right now, and why did I move to T-Mobile? Because it was significantly cheaper for a family plan than some of the bigger or historically bigger carriers. So I think T-Mobile already has a brand that's like, we're fun and we're cheap.
Right.
So if you think about what young people often want, fun and cheap sounds great, right?
I like fun and cheap.
Yeah, I do too. And I'm not even young.
Yeah.
So I wonder if this is a way to kind of capture even more of their business and get a demographic that's already really comfortable doing digital phone-based financial transactions and just get on in there. Also, I'm sure you can make sure that you'll get your phone bill paid if you're T-Mobile.
Oh, you certainly will. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure you get some sort of points if you do the direct deposit thing or the auto withdrawal thing. I wonder also, this is one, if you kind of take a step back, this is one in many, many non-traditional retail banking companies getting into the space.
Mm-hmm.
Goldman Sachs, of course, and many other players. What gives? Why are all these companies not getting into the digital banking space? Is it really all that bad and people have to kind of disrupt that market from the Cities and Chases and Wells Fargo's of the world? Or is it just they see an opportunity to drive some business value is the way they would frame it?
That's a really good question. So I think I'd answer it in probably a few different levels. If you think back to the last 30, even 40 years, you've actually seen many non-traditional finance players get into some component of financing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this has been happening since like the really mass introduction of department store credit cards that you can only use in that department store, right? So if you think of it in terms of just there's been this ever encroachment of financial services being introduced by non-financial firms. I think that is a piece of it. I also think that we are looking at some really big technology and demographic shifts that probably make it a lot easier for these companies to actually get in there. Yeah. And you've already got all these other, you know, MasterCard, it looks like they're the card processor or card branding for T-Money. And you have all of these other smaller banks that we've talked about kind of allowing their operational base and bank charter to be utilized by these other companies. Everybody's doing it, so why shouldn't you?
So it's basically a combination of, you know, we can do it now. There's like WebBank in Utah, all the online-only banks in Utah, they can power all the new fintech stuff as well, and it's just cheaper. But I wonder whether they see this as a money-making thing or just a customer experience thing. Who knows?
Yeah.
Or just a branding experience.
Especially at 4% APR, or APY, I should
APY,
say.
APY, yeah. That seems pretty high. I mean,
yeah.
that is quite high, actually. With the caveat, of course, that it's a small, yeah.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what the other big phone players do. I mean, there are only two, so it's not a long list to watch.
Yeah, I have it. I have a note on my computer. I have the number for Verizon because I have Sprint now, and Sprint is so terrible where I live, and it's also way cheaper. So for my family, this is getting into the weeds, but for my family plan, my wife and I pay $75 a month for unlimited data and calling from Sprint. And even despite that price, I'm looking to go somewhere else because it's just so terrible.
Well, paying for service that doesn't actually work, that never feels like a good value. But of course, Sprint is in the process of being merged or acquired by, I can't even remember anymore.
I think it's
by T-Mobile.
Yeah.
Oh, it's definitely T-Mobile, but I just can't remember if they built it as a merger or an acquisition.
Because,
you know, people's egos really matter.
Of course.
So, you know, you're going to be with me on that T-Mobile plan before you know it, and our fee is higher than yours, just so you know.
Ah, yeah. Well, that's...
They'll probably grandfather you in.
I'm hoping, yeah. Although I still have to use their crappy network. Yeah.
But we can't keep talking about your phone bill anymore,
no,
Steve.
No,
we got to move on.
Yeah, we got to move on. On to credit cards.
All right. Actually, before we talk about credit cards, we're going to talk about IPOs in Silicon Valley. And this particular segment isn't going to be super laser focused on the fintech scene, but I think it is something that's interesting to keep in mind as we ponder the many, many, many upcoming IPOs of 2019. So The Economist, which has a limited number of articles available for non-subscribers to read, so just FYI, had a really informative and well-written article about all the unicorns coming out of the enchanted forest and going to market. And it's a fairly substantial article, and I'm not going to cover everything that it covers, but I do want to headline a couple of the main key points in there. So one of the elements that we look at, if we look at the largest unicorns, and I'm thinking of companies like Uber, Lyft, WeWork, Pinterest, Tencent Gaming, there's a much longer list. If you look at them, they have, many of them have been attempting what's called blitz scaling. So they're trying to absolutely prioritize hyper growth as much as they can so that they can be the one to capture the network effect of whatever market they're in. So that's kind of seemed like accepted wisdom, and that's why investors kind of tolerate, you know, Uber losing more than $3 billion in a year, right? Because it's all in service of the growth of the business. But this particular columnist posits that the pursuit of this blitz scaling at ever higher valuations is actually a form of groupthink that's plaguing kind of the unicorn class in Silicon Valley in general.
Well, I think that even the use of the term unicorn itself, it's like that's some arbitrary mark that you have to meet. And once you're in the club, you're in the club. It's just a weird way to track a company.
And they actually talk about the origin of that term. And the venture capitalist who coined the term, when she did so, there were 38 companies in the world that actually met the marker. And now it's something on the order of about 150.
So
even the term itself is as a unicorn indicating something special and rare, well, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, like a rainbow background. Like everybody's got one now. You're
not
special.
It was supposed to be rare, but yeah, yeah. I think there's what, 7 unicorns in NSF alone?
Yes, there must be for sure. So we've talked about, actually, I'm not sure that we've necessarily talked a lot about network effects here on the podcast, but I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with them. And this article is saying that network effects are quite powerful, but it does depend on the context. And it's not clear that a lot of these firms that are gearing up for their IPOs, like Uber, Lyft, WeWork, Spotify, it's not clear that they actually have the kinds of moats that actually really solidify your network effect. What do I mean by that? Well, it's really easy. If I don't like the price that Uber's giving me, well, I can just go use Lyft. And that is also the same if I'm a driver, much less a passenger.
Which most people have. I used to have both Uber and Lyft before I gave up on Uber, but mm-hmm. It's easier to do both. As a driver also, you see both stickers on the cars, right? You see Uber
totally.
And Lyft in most cases. And in New York, you see, I think it's called Get Around or something?
Yep.
Or Get. Mm-hmm. So there's at least one big city that has a third player, so it's become very commodified.
The barriers to entry are pretty low, and particularly because when you compare, say, a writing service to something like a Facebook, your writing service, you really need to be strong in that exact geography that you're in or that your customer is in or that your driver is in. But that's not really the case for Facebook, right? The more people who are on Facebook, the better it is for Facebook and the better it is for all of their users. Mm-hmm. But the network effects don't really play out the same. So we've got that dynamic in play. And almost all of these companies are losing significant amounts of money. So for example, 84% of companies pursuing IPOs right now have no profits. 10 years ago, the proportion was just 33%. So we are currently at a place where the unprofitability ratio of firms slated for IPOs is up to pre-dot-com crash bubbles.
Love it.
Yeah. So that is something to think about. And this article also talks a lot about how for many of these firms, they've been able to exploit basically regulatory inattention. And both regulators and public perceptions have dramatically shifted over the last few years around, you know, the trade-offs involved with technology of all kinds. So there's a sense that a lot of these companies are really under the gun to go public, not because they're necessarily ready to go public, not because we all think it's going to be a beautiful success story for their stock, but because many of them have been around for about 10 years. Their original investors are ready to cash out.
Those funds have to close at some point.
They got to close. Yeah. They want to cash out, and they want to dump, my word, not the economists. They want to dump these shares on the public. So
didn't Buffett famously sell his whole stake in Lyft after IPO? Or was it Carl Icahn or something? Some titan of finance.
I'm not sure.
I think one day after the Lyft, we'll put this in the show notes, but I think that one day after the Lyft IPO, they sold their shares in Lyft.
And what a smart move for them, because Lyft's stock has had a bit of a rocky road and is lower now than it was at its IPO price.
Right.
So, very interesting article, worth reading, even if you can't stay to read all of the other things on The Economist website. But also something to think about if you are considering investing yourself in some of these post-IPO stocks. And also, The Economist has great charts, and this article is no exception. So if you are a chart person, definitely give it a look. All right. Now we're going to talk about what Steve thought I was going to talk about before. We're going to talk about credit card marketing.
Give me some plastic.
That is some sexy business. I know that's what everybody's been thinking.
Paper and plastic. It seems like I get a lot of mailers every day. Maybe due to my perfect FICO score.
Oh, God. Not this again.
Will not go unremarked upon on any show. But I wonder, why am I getting so much mail for credit cards?
Well, you and everybody else have been getting lots of mail for credit cards for a very long time. It's kind of staggering the amount of money that financial service or credit card firms spend on snail mail to get you to sign up. So, for example, Capital One spent $377 million on mailed pitches in 2018. And Discover, which is, you know, kind of a small potatoes player in the credit card space, they spent $196 million. So historically, that has really been where credit card companies spent a lot of their money and their time on this. Even though, you know, you don't really get a great response. You get something like a less than 1% customer acquisition rate out of these mailers. So banks are looking for other ways to spend their money, and they are finding it in social media.
Oh, God.
And it's not like, oh, well, we'll just put an ad on Facebook or we'll put an ad on Instagram. No, 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 no.
It's got to be native.
They got to get their influencers. Yeah. So the next time you see somebody with a lot of followers, like prominently displaying their saver card at a restaurant with a beautiful glass of wine, they better disclose that they're getting paid to do that. I hope
Hashtag
they do.
Ad. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Come on, FTC. But these numbers are going up quite a bit. So Capital One, which by the way is the fifth largest U.S. credit card issuer, they have been paying Instagram and Twitter users that have between 100,000 to 1 million followers to post photos, mostly of these restaurant settings for their particular saver card. Part of the reason they're doing this is that credit card issuances have slowed since 2017. Mm-hmm. They had years of healthy growth, but now it's slowing, and credit card issuers are finding themselves having to kind of up the rewards, but consumers are getting really savvy, and so they game the rewards, right?
Oh,
they like get that card, they get those big bumps, they do what they need to do to get some great trip or some bonus, and then they close that account and go get a new one.
Funny story. I actually have a funny story about the this world that I'm not a part of, but I have a friend that, let's call him John, whose friend Mike is a big credit card person,
mm-hmm.
and Mike was upset at John because John wouldn't let Mike pay for his MacBook Pro on Mike's credit card so that Mike could meet his minimum whatever transaction volume. So it created kind of a huge rift. I have no idea why he would lend him, but it created a huge rift. So now you have this people that kind of want to game the system, get a little points, whatever. And it's a lot of, you know, I think you have to spend sometimes $3,000 or so in the first quarter when you get the card. So, you know, the argument is that you get all these free trips and miles and whatever, but you also have to put a lot of throughput through your wallet.
Oh, like
you have to,
my gosh.
The volumes must be insane for you to meet the requirements of these cards.
I have two comments. Friends, don't let credit cards get between your friendships, number one. And number two, don't be somebody who gets these cards and needs to put all these dollars on there if you're not also going to pay it off each and every month. It's just really not worth it.
It's not worth the miles.
It's not
worth the Hyatt points.
And that is unsolicited financial advice, and I'm not a professional, but I did feel the need to share. So anyway, I think what we can expect here is to see lots and lots more of the kind of native digital advertising. So be on the lookout because, you know, everybody's selling something. And at the same time, even though it looks like for this year, you're going to see more than half of the dollars that are spent by these types of firms on new customer acquisitions, more than half of that is going to get spent on digital platforms. Nonetheless, you're still going to be getting those applications in the mail. They're not going anywhere.
They must work, right? It has to work.
Less than 1%.
That's still, that must be high enough for them to keep doing it. Because I literally get a mailer at least 3 times a week in my house.
Yeah. Anyway. Saver.
Yeah.
I shouldn't give them that much free marketing.
Yeah.
You can see the appeal here, right? So mailers, firms, you know, financial firms could get a lot of marketing data about people. Probably, I wouldn't even be surprised if they have dastardly ways of getting your credit card score or credit report. And if you think about what using influencers to target customers, it's very similar, right? You can kind of look at the demographics of the influencers. I personally don't know what information Facebook provides back to advertisers and or users themselves around their followers, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's all kinds of deep data analysis and marketing around, oh, well, you know, we really want to grow our credit card business in a particular part of the world. So we're going to look for influencers who are, you know, substantially more popular there, for example. So you're the product. It was ever thus.
Yep.
All right. Well, now it's time for our final bites. This is where we share a number that is just stuck in our minds. Steve, you go first.
Great. So my number is actually $130 million. And that is how much Masayoshi Son, he of a famously SoftBank and Division Fund, lost by betting on Bitcoin. So apparently he bought Bitcoin when it was at its very, very peak in 2017. No idea when he sold it, but ended up losing $130 million. A vastly princely, kingly sum for you and I, but I think a drop in the bucket for him, but still must sting to lose that much money.
I was thinking the exact same thing. Oh, to be in a position to lose $130 million and really not have it affect your life at all.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Or affect your reputation for strong business sense.
Yeah.
Between WeWork, Uber, and Bitcoin, I guess we'll see how Son does.
Two out of three, yeah. Two out of three and bad.
All right, now it's my turn. And my final bite is $5.6 billion. $5.6 billion is the rough amount that the creator of Bitcoin, his own personal stash, is estimated to be worth. And the reason I'm even talking about this is because John McAfee has been in the news saying that he, one of the original most hardcore hackers of all, has discovered the identity of Satoshi Nakamoto.
So who is
he? And he will reveal it. And then he said, well, I don't want to reveal it just yet because it might mess with my extradition situation. Which that right there tells you a lot about what you need to know about John McAfee.
Is he in Nicaragua, Belize, somewhere in Central America?
Apparently he's back in the U.S. right now. But I would, for our readers, just like to read a short summary from this article in Bloomberg about John McAfee. The entrepreneur founded McAfee Associates in 1987, though the company has since passed through several hands. He was a person of interest in a murder in Belize, after which he returned to the U.S. In recent years, McAfee has been investing in digital coins as well as promoting them, for a fee, in his own Twitter feed. He is also running for U.S. president. What? This guy. Really a true Renaissance man who I think is probably yanking our chain.
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting here is that whether or not McAfee is right about who the creator of Bitcoin is, whether or not the creator is alive or dead, those coins are still out there. And if they do get sold, it is quite likely to bring the value of Bitcoin down, even if they're not sold all at once. Apparently, some of the market patterns have been that when, is it Mount Gox or Jox? I never
Gox.
Knew. Gox.
Yeah.
Such a weird word. Why do people do that? Before Mount Gox went defunct, every time that they sold, they put Bitcoin out on the market, it led to a substantial drop in the Bitcoin price. So the fun never ends with Bitcoin. What would we talk about on this podcast if it weren't for Bitcoin?
Yeah, the crazy Bitcoin market, yeah.
There's only so much credit card marketing you can cover. All right. With that, we're going to call it for this week. And thank you so much for listening. If you have comments, questions, or ideas for topics for us to cover, you know where to find us. Our email is in the show notes.
All righty. Talk at you next week.